KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
We're going to bring you the announcement from President Obama about his new members of his security team. That's coming up at 10 o'clock, so Nancy Pearl will not be our guest after all. She'll be with us later in the week. We're going to talk about race and how to speak about race in America a little bit later. But first, as the Liquor Control Board sorts out how legalized marijuana will be sold, companies are offering their services. One company making a pitch is Medbox, the creators of a prescription drug dispensing machine guarded by a trained operator using fingerprint verification and computer documentation. It's a far cry from the pot vending machines people have been joking about. Dr. Bruce Bedrick is the CEO of Medbox. He's a former practicing naturopath and chiropractor. I asked him why his machine would be a good thing for a legal marijuana system.
It would make it the safest, most secure way to inventory control, store, and dispense the medicine.
And why is that necessary for legal marijuana any more or less than it would be necessary for legal alcohol?
And I think the answer to that is diversion, because it may be even legal for some people. It won't be legal for everybody. Plus, it's also not going to be legal in other states. And so on some levels, although we don't know exactly to what degree, there may be some limits. And I don't know what those limits are. So if there are limits, it also helps in that aspect, too. The tracking, the real-time tracking abilities to limit the dispense are also very important here. And so we don't know until the state of Washington truly creates the new rules and regulations by which the industry will operate. But whatever it is that they come up with, this technology that we have patented will create the safest, most secure, most legally compliant way to operate from a distribution perspective, whether it's at a dispensary or at a store or some other way.
What is Medbox? What do you produce and where is it distributed?
One is in consulting. We help in the medical marijuana arena. If people need help or are interested in getting into the industry, they contact us and we help them get involved in the industry in various areas, whether it's cultivation or opening a dispensary, so on and so forth. So when in this particular instance, in terms of Washington, when the law, the outright legalization takes effect, there'll be people who want to get in and open up a dispensary or open up a site to retail it or become cultivators. They would hire us and we would help them do that. We are also medical technology manufacturers and retailers with things such as the Medbox. We expect our technology to really revolutionize the way people acquire their medicines or prescription medicines from both doctor's offices and retailers like Walgreens and CVS.
I saw a video of your company's work, and it looked like you had to have a fingerprint, you had to have ID, you had an account. Is it a way of controlling the number of people who touch the medication between production and distribution?
What we're really about, we're all about providing access to patients and people to use the medication, or in this case, the herb, from a state's rights to a human rights to a consciousness level. We love this opportunity to help people gain access to the herb. On the other hand, we want to make sure it's done in the most safe and secure way as possible, and thus the technology is the right opportunity and the right technology for this industry, as well as for prescription pharmaceuticals.
Medbox, according to your website, has 130 locations right now, and that includes medical marijuana dispensaries. How do they
Correct.
Operate in the medical marijuana dispensaries?
Depending upon the state, first of all, patient has to get their doctor's recommendation, and then they'll get a state-issued ID card. So they will come to a dispensary, and the patient will register on their first visit as a new patient. We take their fingerprint, and they receive a Medbox card, which kind of is a HIPAA-compliant ID card. Doesn't have any of their information on it, but that in combination with their medical marijuana ID card from the state and their fingerprint allows them to get in on further visits into the dispensing room, which is through an electronic security door inside of the dispensary. Inside of the dispensing room, the patients see all of the medicines that are available, all of the infused products in display cases, choose what they want, and the technician that or the staffer that works there has the patient slide their card, provide their fingerprint, and the biometric fingerprint is there once again to prevent fraud and verify that the patient is who they are. And the staffer, you know, presses a button or two, and the medicine is dispensed out of the machine. The machine is sat behind the counter.
People first started seeing headlines, and it was like, oh, marijuana vending machines. But you reiterated that that would not be how they would work. They wouldn't work in a Walgreens or a 7-Eleven.
Correct. It's the, you know, there's not going to be an all-access pass to marijuana all over the place. Even in new upcoming rules in Washington, it is going to be very safe, it's going to be very secure, and it's going to be regulated, even though it's going to be legal.
How much would they cost?
Our technology runs for $50,000, but for $50,000, you get all of the technology, all of the software, all of the hardware that would be used to operate a facility.
Why does that make sense economically for someone? Why couldn't they just hire somebody at $13 an hour to do that work?
First and foremost, once again, it's a security issue. Number two, the humans, there's always human error. When you remove humans from the transport and dispensing process, then you are run a safer, less expensive operation.
Dr. Bruce Bredrick is a MedBox CEO. He was a practicing chiropractor and trained as a naturopath as well. This is a business opportunity as well. MedBox is reportedly one of dozens of companies that are contacting the state, offering its services as the state figures out the rules for setting up legal marijuana distribution. What do your number counters tell you about the potential for the business opportunity here?
We don't really have projections for the state of Washington. It's too early to tell. We don't know what the rules are going to look like. What's most important for us is making sure that the state gets it right and offering our help to make sure that we provide the appropriate counsel, if they'll even hear us, about how to create a program that really prohibits diversion.
Is diversion a problem with states that have medical marijuana?
I would say California there is, off the cuff. California has medical marijuana, but it's not regulated. In the states that are regulated, there's really not that much of an issue. But once they're regulated well, there's no issue.
California's tried to crack down on that proliferation
sure.
of medical marijuana dispensaries.
Sure.
Is that
California
the kind of,
needs help.
Are there states that are doing it really well in terms of the medical marijuana distribution?
They're going to start. They're going to start. The more and more states that jump on board, we're witnessing the end of prohibition, you know, in our lifetimes here, especially with the comments made by President Obama, you know, just before the travesty in Connecticut, where he said that basically it's going to be hands off. So things are happening, and I think states will move in the direction of allowing medical marijuana at least to start. And I think as that happens, lessons will be learned from each state moving forward, and it'll become safer and more secure.
Are you getting inquiries from states that have yet to establish medical marijuana?
In the states that have yet to establish, no.
So once people vote, then they're looking for services.
Right.
They're coming to somebody like you.
Right. And we don't charge for those services. Those are free services.
Those are free services?
Yeah.
Where do you make your money?
We make our money just by selling our technology and the consulting services to the private sector.
Growth industry, I imagine, at this point.
Yeah, it's still in its embryonic form, but you know, we're looking forward to a prosperous future for everybody. This is really an opportunity for our entire country, you know, to take a step forward from economically and consciously, it's just a tremendous, tremendous opportunity for everybody.
And for you personally, as a naturopath, a chiropractor, how'd you get involved in the medical marijuana industry? Why is it something that you think is important enough to pursue?
I lost my mom to metastatic breast cancer when I was 10, and I'm an only child to my mother. And it was the worst thing anybody could ever experience. And that's back in 1979 and 80, where they did surgery and chemotherapy and radiation, and it was a miserable, miserable experience. And I know, had medical marijuana been available as a legal option to my mother, that she would not have suffered like she had. She couldn't eat. She couldn't make it from the bed to the table without being in complete pain and with no appetite. So it just ate her up alive, and it was just terrible. And of course, moving through my professional career, I kept my ear to the ground. I watched the industry grow in California, and I'm a big believer, a big proponent of its anti-cancer effects and its therapeutic benefits and what it can do for people who are sick. And one thing led to another. I met my partner, and it's been wonderful ever since. That's the short version.
Dr. Bruce Bedrick was a practicing chiropractor, trained as a naturopath. He is CEO of MedBox, which offers consulting services and a dispensing machine for those in the medical marijuana community and at some point in the future as it's legalized to the broader legal marijuana community. Thanks for talking to us.
Hey, Steve, thank you so much for your interest. I really appreciate you having me on.
Fifty degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle. Forecast says we should expect it to be breezy and cloudy all day with rain at times and a high temperature right around 50.
On the next Living on Earth, a look back at the environmental successes of 2012.
We're seeing a lot of movement that I thought was improbable on creating large marine protected areas and shark sanctuaries.
I'm Steve Curwood, the good, the bad, and the hopeful. That's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Tonight at 10 o'clock, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Alaska USA Federal Credit Union. For over three generations, Alaska USA members have shared the goal of helping each other get places worth going with savings accounts, loans, investments, insurance policies, and more. On the web at alaskausa.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:17. Later this hour, how will Medicare pay its beneficiaries in the years to come? We're going to talk about that with Medicare expert Marilyn Moon. And that's just about 25 minutes away.
But first, when you look at another person, do you see color? Do you see race? Two people have been asking each other that question as they sit down at dinner tables around America. They have found, well, let's find out what they found. Sharon Leslie Morgan is a descendant of American slaves. She is founder of OurBlackAncestry.com, a website devoted to helping people appreciate and explore their heritage. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thomas Norman DeWolf is a descendant of one of America's largest slave trading families, bringing at least 10,000 Africans to America's shore. He's also author of Inheriting the Trade, A Northern Family Confronts Its Legacy as the Largest Slave Trading Dynasty in the U.S., in U.S. history. I'm not going to add another word to that. Since
it's
that's
the longest title in...
And together, they started a journey which they have recounted in their book, Gather at the Table. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Define that journey for me. What's your journey that you decided to embark upon?
Well, metaphorically, the journey is the journey toward understanding and peace and reconciliation, understanding how slavery affected the psyche of everyone who still lives in America today, and how it has informed the social structures that govern our lives. And I think that what we were trying to do is to look at things from both sides of the equation as a black person and a white person and a man and a woman and people who were in opposition in a lot of ways, and to make sense of and figure out how to get over this conundrum that we seem to have about race.
The conundrum being that we continue to have it?
We continue to have it. And, you know, it's like this is hundreds of years later, and it is something that still affects us every day, and it is something that comes out very violently at certain moments in history, like presidential elections. And so it's something that we really need to solve. And our personal feeling is that one way of approaching that was to take people from opposite sides. It would be it's hard to understand maybe how a person who had so many people in her family who were enslaved, could actually go on the road with somebody who was one of the largest slave trading dynasties, descendant of one of the largest slave trading dynasties in history.
100 years.
Because that is definitely in opposition.
150 years later.
Yes.
That's still...
That is still an issue.
Top of mind.
That is still very... I'm a genealogist. It is top of mind for me every day.
You know, I was wondering, people who whose families came in the teens and 20s and 30s up to today... Is it part of their legacy as well?
Yeah, because one great example is that slavery built the economic foundation of the Western world. It built America, being able to have access to free labor. And therefore, anybody who achieves a benefit now is achieving it based on that foundation. And you look at the disparities that continue to exist in African-American communities, and yes, that disparity goes back 150 years or more.
You know, we had a conversation with somebody 2 weeks ago, a scholar 2 weeks ago, about how proof that the Smithsonian, the castle, had been built was slave labor. But he also said, you know, the White House, Capitol building, all have been built with slave labor. That's not one of the stories Americans tell themselves.
There's a whole lot of stories Americans don't, not only don't tell ourselves, we don't know them because they've been successfully buried. And that's one of the most, I guess, remarkable things to me over the past decade and a half is learning all these things that I never learned in school. And, you know, we go to a lot of schools and we'll ask, how many people in here learned this stuff? And it's really rare, you know, and we'll read about the, you know, the textbook committees that are trying to whitewash, pun intended, the American history and, you know, keep our icons, you know, as white as the marble statues with which they're represented and, you know, the clean heroes and what have you, and not struggle with the wounds.
You know, John Meacham wrote a recent biography of Thomas Jefferson,
yeah.
And he talks about he recounts a visit to Jefferson's house, to Monticello, where and this is somebody else recounting this, eating at the table and being served by slaves. And the person who's writing the story looks up and he sees Jefferson. He looks behind him and sees this young man serving Jefferson. And he says, well, you know, these people are related. But you hear nothing of that
right.
In the time. And Meacham's argument was, well, people had different attitudes. What do you make of that? I mean, do we have to interpret them within their time for something like that and the legacy that Jefferson left, Hemings and all those families?
I personally struggle with that because I have been told repeatedly, and to a certain degree accept that you have to view people within the context of their times. But having visited the slave dungeons in Cape Coast Castle and Elmina in Ghana, West Africa, and seeing the conditions within which people are held, knowing that when people are in the hold of a ship moaning and screaming and crying and bleeding, they're making human sounds that the white captains and crew members can't possibly think that these are not human people, even though the records indicate that, you know, these are the same as any other possession, cattle and dogs and implements for farming and what have you. And so I try not to hyperbolize. I try to maintain some bit of context, but I think that I can't imagine that these folks didn't know that what was being done was evil. And they knew that it was evil, but they did it anyway because it profited them, you know, financially and in many other ways. So it's I'll accept it to a certain degree, but I'm not going to cut people loose. I mean, in Jefferson's time, there were plenty of newspaper articles accusing him of having children with Sally Hemings. You know, it's coming from a political battle, but this was not unheard of at all.
Do we cut Jefferson any slack for being a man of his times?
Yeah, I sort of think, well, I don't know if we call it cutting slack.
Yeah, well,
but I think that you can't take modern mores and go back into the past and say, well, if I had lived then, I would have done this. Because people are very much informed by the society in which they live, and those were the mores of the society. But as Tom says, I cannot imagine how someone could be so debased as to debase other human beings in that way, to the point of not considering them to be human. And those are my ancestors. And I have an ancestor who has 17 children with this nephew of her owner. And I just can't conceive of, you can't give permission in a situation like that. So I can't see where there was a love relationship, even if they had 17 kids. So I think the issue of the morality of it is something that is timeless. And I can't cut any slack on that one.
You wrote about asking yourself the question, if you had been enslaved, what would
you have
done?
What would I have done? If I had been enslaved with the modern mentality that I have, you'd be reading about me still in newspapers. But I probably would have done as my great-grandmother did. I mean, she had 17 kids, so, you know, whether she liked it or not. And you know, so I think I cannot impose this modern sensibility on that. But on the morality, I think you can.
Sharon Leslie Morgan and Thomas Norman DeWolf are authors of Gather at the Table. You have said that that the genealogy and the study of genealogy is what brought you here to these, to wanting to understand.
Yes.
Have you had conversations with others who have said that same thing?
Or yes.
Have you had conversation with others who have said, I want to know a little bit and know more?
There are many people who do say that they don't want to know. And our immediate relatives, when I was a child, my great-grandmother was alive and she was enslaved.
Wow.
But I was a little child, so I didn't know to ask. And people didn't talk about their experiences because after slavery, then there's Jim Crow. I mean, there's those 100 more years of problems. So people didn't really talk about it. They just left. Like my family, they left Alabama, they left Mississippi, and they came to Chicago where they had a whole different form of segregation and problems. But they didn't want to burden you with the bad stories because they wanted you to do better. They wanted you to think better. They wanted the world to treat you better. So they created communities where there was hope that that could happen. So yes, there are a lot of people who don't want to talk about it, but there are a lot of people that do. And now that we've realized that there are records and people think that there are not, there are ways now where you can look into your past and you can find your ancestors. You may not be able to go all the way, but you can go a lot farther than you could before.
You know, you both have talked about how African Americans have these conversations with themselves, but that white people don't, or that they pretend they don't have to. What's the white privilege involved there? Which I imagine that's part of what it is.
Yeah, I think it's a form of kind of self-induced amnesia. I think white people, by and large, not all, but by and large, are raised oblivious to this history, and not in an overt way. It's kind of a subconscious thing, but we don't deal with these issues. We don't think about the fact that we have African Americans, Asian Americans, Mexican Americans, and white guy, I'm just American. I'm the default color. I'm the default race who doesn't really have a race. And we don't have these conversations because we have the privilege not to. We don't carry the negative impacts. We may get really upset if we don't, you know, the Bakke case back in the 70s or 80s, you know, who sued successfully because of affirmative action and gets, you know, the ball rolling to get rid of affirmative action. But we don't think about white forms of affirmative action, how the GI Bill, which was to give benefits to veterans from World War II initially, for housing, education, job creation, 98% of that money went to white veterans. And that builds the all-white suburbs. And then we finance our schools through property taxes. Well, all the rich white people are living in the suburbs, and what's left in the inner cities, urban areas, there's a reason why we've built this country the way we've ended up building it. Even though it's ignorant, it's on purpose.
You told Tom, I heard this in an interview, I think it was in the on NBC or MSNBC, that he was going to hear things from you that would sound harsh or unkind. I'm sort of paraphrasing. What did he hear? What'd you tell him?
Oh, I don't know if I can say this on the air.
Well, say no, only the words that are legal.
We made a promise that we would be totally honest. And many of these are off-the-cuff comments. So we would go and see things. And the point was seeing the same thing at the same time.
For example?
And then analyzing. Like the reconciliation statue in Richmond, Virginia, which is at the end of a slave trail. Virginia was a key point of export when people were sold downriver. They were sold downriver, the James River in Virginia. So you go down this slave trail, and then at the end, there's a reconciliation statue.
What does it look like?
It's a big bronze, tall, it's on a pillar, and there are three of them in the world. So they're at major sites of slave incident. So there's one at Liverpool, there's one in the Gambia, and there's one in Richmond, Virginia. And I didn't want to go on this trail. And I was just really angry and really hurt because you could just feel how bloody it was. And I reacted by, I'm not going on the trail. And Tom really didn't understand. And I really didn't want to exude profanity or anything. So I ended up going on the trail. And at the end, we talked about it. But there have been eruptions of emotion. There have been times when I thought I wanted to kill him. There have been times...
For things he said or just because of
just because
who he represented?
White.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's like you are representing the whole white race right now.
Right, right.
And I really am hating you right now. And you try to be a sensible person. So you try to think about it before you actually open your mouth. But I want to say things very honestly. So I've not exploded and attacked him physically, but I have certainly said things verbally that were very uncomfortable.
Did you return the favor?
You know what's interesting about this is I think both of us, people will read in the book of incidents where we tangled. I mean, we wanted not only to be honest with each other, but to be really honest in what we shared in the stories of our journey and times when we were in pretty serious conflict and how we worked through it. And, you know, the whole concept of what we intended to do was to live this model of healing that had been taught to us through this group called Coming to the Table. And that through what we have learned about trauma and understanding trauma and resilience to trauma and how unhealed trauma gets passed down generation to generation and how only, you know, people who harm other people are themselves harmed, which is the beginning for having compassion for people who cause great harm. And so in trying to live that, that's also part of the commitment. The truth, the bluntness is balanced with this commitment to really wanting to test out this model of healing that you're, yes, you're going to be honest, you're going to be truthful, but you're trying to get to a place of justice, a place of peace, and a place of healing together.
That sounds like you, representing all African Americans,
yes,
have to forgive him and us, him.
That's true, but like Gloria Steinem said, the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off. So I spent a lot of time being pissed off.
But, you know, all right, so you said about trauma, it's passed down.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've heard this. That was 150 years ago.
Yeah.
Stop
yeah.
being
yeah.
victims. Give it up. You're not, this is the modern world. Where does that, is there any truth in that as for an individual as opposed to a cohort in time?
Yeah, because the cycle keeps repeating itself and people are still being victimized. And I think one of the big conversations that has to happen is amongst white people, because they are the ones that are saying that. They're the ones who say, oh, well, now you're playing the race card. Okay, well, you play the race card every day. Okay, and when you stop playing yours, I'll stop playing mine. And that's one of the things that we learn, because that's part of the victim cycle. It's like, you hurt me, so I hurt you, so you hurt me back, and then I go hurt somebody else, you know, and then it never ends, and it has not ended.
Sharon Leslie Morgan, Tom DeWolf are authors of Gather at the Table. What does that mean? What have you done? How have you gathered at the table, personally?
We're literally still sitting around this table speaking to
yes,
you.
Yes, indeed.
This is it.
This is it.
And then, but you also do it privately, right? You do it at people's homes. You do it at institutions. You're going to be at the Northwest African American Museum tonight.
That was yesterday.
You're going to be at Ellensburg tomorrow night.
Ellensburg tomorrow.
And Pullman on the 10th.
Correct.
So yesterday at the museum, were you around a table? Were you on stage? Same sort of notion, though, I imagine.
It's clearly metaphorical. But the two of us together have traveled through 27 states and Washington, D.C., and, you know, a couple of weeks in the island of Tobago, you know, revisiting the places of the wounds, the places where people have attempted to heal and to learn and to test these theories and what have you together, spending time in each other's homes, with each other's families, with each other's grandchildren. And you know, touring where we grew up and what informed how we became the people that we became.
Genealogical research in archives.
Yeah.
Towns where his ancestors came from, the mansion where the slave traders lived and built.
And part of it is that we made this commitment not just to gather at the table, but to stay at the table. And that's the part that's hard.
But you're somebody who took this idea on even before you came to gather the table.
Yeah.
Have you brought, I mean, what about the white people who don't know that they need to have this conversation? How have they reacted? Or are you only speaking to the committed, to the people who are already on the journey?
You know, one of the reasons that Sharon and I do what we do and spend so much time away from our homes and family on the road is to share these stories for white people. I hope they're inspired by this book not to travel through 27 states. Nobody's going to do that, spend 3 years of their life doing this, but to find their journey. To find where they are, how they walk in the world, and what they can do in their own life, the life of their families and their communities. I mean, when I was in the dungeon at Cape Coast Castle, one of the things I will never forget, Professor Kofi Anyidoho said to us that slavery is a living wound under a patchwork of scars. And until we're willing to remove those scars and clean the wound properly, we're never going to heal. So if I can somehow share that message in ways that click with people, and for me particularly, my interest is in white people and more specifically white men, the symbol of power and control and oppression throughout centuries and centuries of history. That's my goal.
What cleans that wound?
Part of it is this complete truth. Honesty. It's acknowledgement of the truth. It's understanding. It's self-education. It's humility. It's recognizing that I, as a white person, have a lot to learn and a lot to do to help clean this wound.
Do Americans in 2013 need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission?
Yeah, it would help.
Absolutely.
Reparations?
Yes.
Yeah, because the flags go up.
But I know that's one of the big deals reparations does not always have to be in the form of money. But yes, there are things that people can do. There was this big movement about apologizing. And it was so superficial that it's kind of like, well, I apologize now. Okay, everything should be good.
Yeah, get over
it. But they just became so empty. You know, it's like there's a House bill that's been up for the last 20 years, House Bill 40, which is to study the effect of slavery and what should happen, what would be fair. And one of the concepts we work with is restorative justice. What restores people to a condition of whole, to a condition of everything is okay? And we don't know what exactly that would be, but there is something, and there should be something, and it should be looked at.
White people freak out about that word.
Just that word.
Oh, I know.
Just that word.
But if they understand the concept of repair,
right,
and what all is involved in repairing the brokenness that we share together, you know, get over yourself with coming up with the walls, the excuse walls that we build up, and recognize the wound. I mean, you get cancer, you're not going to. I guess some people are going to ignore it, but most people are going to want to find out what caused this disease and come up with the appropriate treatment to cure it to the degree possible. And this racism is a disease that we continue to perpetuate. So until we come to terms with it, until we make the commitment, the lifelong commitment, to not allow this to continue, well, that living wound will go on living.
Even in an America that's going to be less than, that will all be a majority country in another 30 years?
White As Tom has pointed out, white people will still be the largest minority.
So I mean, you're still going to have 14% black and, you know, right, 20% Hispanic, but 45% are going to be white people. And who's going to still control the money and the government and the power structures? White men.
And I used to live in South Africa, and I went there just as, quote, the end of apartheid happened and Mr. Mandela became the president. Then they had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and I got to see all of these things. And one of the things that is very interesting is that apartheid really hasn't ended even today. The banks, the insurance companies, and the land are still owned by the settlers, the white people. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission didn't go far enough because a lot of people just refused to participate. And it's like, well, I'm not going because this white point of view is I did what I had to do.
And that's one of the interesting things is this: the complexity of this is our particular focus is on black and white issues, but it's gender, it's class,
right,
it's politics, religion.
It's power.
It's power.
Uh-huh.
But if you work on one of these things intensively, it will help with all of those other things. As the isms start falling, you deal with one and the other ones will be like dominoes. They'll fall right in line.
When you go to Ellensburg, for example, tomorrow, Ellensburg is a largely white town, but you know there were blacks in Ellensburg 150 years ago, or maybe not that long, 100 years ago. What's the message? What's your message to the people who are turning out? And then I'll get yours. But what's your message to those? Because my point is you're not just going to Seattle, liberal places. You're trying to move out into the whole world, whole country.
The big message is that this is still a problem. And young people, we're going to university, many times don't see that it still is. They don't recognize the privilege. They don't recognize the racism. They think that everything is okay because they don't have an historical view, a backward view, to be able to know how things were and how our society is really organized. And it's operating on automatic. So you just have to be really conscious of what's happening today and know that it is a problem and that we believe that it can be solved. And it's not about a national movement to solve it. It is about each individual person finding it within their heart and within their mind to educate themselves and to live their lives differently.
Do you think that when we hear about how young people today are less conscious of race because they have many of them and many of their friends are multiracial? Do you think that's a sort of another gloss over what's actually happening?
Yeah, that's part of saying that once we had a black president, now we're a post-racial society. Your race and your sexual orientation are too fundamental to your identity for you to ignore them. I would never expect anyone to be colorblind or to not see race because you see it. It's in your face. That's how we got to be slaves, because you can see, therefore we could not escape. And that was a technique. And I think that's the same technique now. We aren't post-racial.
By the way, you said you had family members that were like cousins, second cousins, that were passing as white?
I had a white grandmother, but we didn't know that she was white because her family disowned her, so she lived around all black people, so she was black. That's what we thought.
Because you had cousins who were
living
on the other side of the barrier.
I have found cousins now who they had lost the knowledge that there was somebody black in their family. So I started calling myself the Dark Angel, and I've been to visit all of them.
And sometimes they had that look
you
on their face.
You get mixed reactions, yes.
What's your goal?
You know, part of what we do in our presentation, it's we try to make it entertaining as well as informative. And so I'd be surprised if there's very many people that come to our presentations that don't learn something that they never knew before. We talk about the disparities that continue to exist and cite, you know, statistical analysis about how any social indicator you want to measure, it is better to be white in America than not white. And my goal is, because I think the first thing people need to do, white people need to do in particular, is educate ourselves. And there's a lot of this stuff that black folks don't know. We run into black folks that have no idea that, you know, the biggest slave trading state in the Union was Rhode Island. And so there's education there for all of us to understand how these seeds got planted and continue to grow. So the first big, huge piece for me is education and sharing of resources so that people can continue, you know, on their own to find out, you know, information that will really help inform them. And if we can get people to stop saying, oh, you're playing the race card and this is, you know, we elected the black guy, can't you just get over it?
Stop trying to make everybody be white.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. You know, it's like, why do I have to change myself to be like you? I should be able to be myself. Everyone of every race should be able to be respected and celebrated for what they are.
Rhode Island was the largest because what they were, that's where the money was being funneled through?
That's where the trading was happening?
All the way through to?
Rhode Island was responsible for 50% of all slave trading in the United States.
And then people would be transported from there to other parts.
They'd take rum from Rhode Island to West Africa, from there
to
you know, 40 different trading ports, North and South America and the Caribbean islands. But the ships, the financing, the insurance, the goods that were taken, Rhode Island.
And just think, anybody who wore cotton clothes, they're participating in the slave trade because slaves grew the cotton.
Well,
so
as we learned,
the South.
All of America.
Yeah.
Sharon Leslie Morgan, Tom DeWolf, authors of Gather at the Table, links at their site to their other books and some of the work they're doing in Ellensburg tomorrow night at Central and at Pullman, Washington State on the 10th. Thank you both.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
It's 9:47, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 50 degrees in Seattle. We've had showers through the morning, and that's likely going to continue for the rest of the day. It's supposed to be breezy and cloudy with a high temperature not much higher than it is right now, 50.
Support for KUOW comes from Rick Steves Europe, hosting Test Drive, a Tour Guide, a day full of travel classes featuring a variety of European destinations. 9 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. in downtown Edmonds, Saturday, January 12th. More information at ricksteves.com.
The housing collapse didn't just hit the United States. It hit Europe, too. There's a lot of cheap property over there. But in Spain, those properties aren't selling. So the Spanish government is offering a deal. You buy a house, you get a green card. Hear our full report this afternoon at 2 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Medical Center's robotic-assisted surgery team. Using advanced technology, UW Medicine surgeons provide robotic-assisted and minimally invasive surgeries designed to enhance patient outcomes and safety. More at uwmedicine.org/stories.
The president is set to make two major cabinet announcements this morning. Former Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel as Secretary of Defense, and counterterrorism advisor John Brennan as director of the CIA. These choices are not without controversy. Special coverage, including the president's announcement and informed analysis, begins just a few minutes from now, this morning at 10, right here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
I'm Steve Scherr, still weekday. So Nancy Pearl will join us at another time since we've been preempted for the president's announcement. A few minutes on Medicare now. The federal health insurance program for people who are 65 or older, certain younger people with disabilities, people with end-stage renal disease. There are different parts of Medicare that cover specific services, A, B, C, and D. A lot of talk during the fiscal cliff negotiations and what is going to come in front of us with discussions about entitlements, so-called entitlements. How will Medicare pay its beneficiaries? How will it be able to remain solvent? A few minutes now on what we're actually talking about. Marilyn Moon is Senior Vice President and Director of the Health Program at the American Institutes for Research. Marilyn Moon, thanks for talking to us.
Well, thanks for asking me to be on your program.
Would you, when you listen to the discussions about Medicare and that Medicare is insolvent, what does that mean when people say that?
First of all, I think it is an exaggeration. The support for the Medicare program comes from part of it for Part A, as you said, there are multiple parts, comes from a dedicated tax, the part of the payroll tax. And that will eventually not have enough funds in the trust fund to pay full benefits under Part A off into the future. But at the moment, we're not in that situation, and there are a lot of things that can be done between now and then. So it's not as dire a situation as many people talk about, although changes need to come for the Medicare program, absolutely.
When you say out in the future, do you mean 2017 or 2030?
I mean more like 2017, and that's not that many years away now. But we've also seen in the past that just a recovery in the economy, if it happened a little faster, for example, that would put off the date because those numbers are all calculated both on the basis of what the spending is but also what the revenues are that come into the program.
What's the most, of course, we know the controversy over whether the Medicare Advantage plans are more or less efficient than the government-only Medicare plan. Where are the biggest cost drivers or drains, depending on how you want to define that, in the Medicare system?
Well, the biggest drivers in essence are twofold right now. One is the fact that we have an increasingly aging population. Baby boomers are beginning to enter Medicare eligibility very rapidly. That itself will boost costs substantially over time. And then the costs per capita are going up, not so much because of Medicare, but because healthcare in general is more expensive. And that exists everywhere, whether you're talking about costs of physician services, costs of hospital care, costs of home health care. So it's across the board. There's a lot there that can be done, but it also means that there are a lot of areas that provide challenges to the program.
How much of the money that the baby boomers have put into Medicare will cover their costs?
Well, not nearly what they put into it will cover their costs. Their costs will be higher than that. But one of the questions is, do we want to look back in time and hold them accountable for playing the game appropriately? They were taxed and told what to pay, and they did. And the fact that we were not successful either in holding down costs over time or in predicting how high the rate of inflation would be. I think it's a little disingenuous to suddenly hold people at age 65 to say, whoops, policymakers made bad choices, so now you're going to have to pony up an enormous amount of money.
Well, if we don't do that, we'll be asking our children to pony up more, won't we?
That's exactly right. We're going to have to decide who is going to pay. It's either going to be beneficiaries will pay more or taxpayers will pay more. There are some other things that can soften that, but we're going to have to make that choice. And one of the questions is who's in better shape to be able to do that?
Well, what's your interpretation today in 2013?
My interpretation is if you're going to do it, and I've been saying this actually for a number of years, and one of the reasons I'm not elected to anything, is many years ago I said tax baby boomers more so that they will pay for their retirement needs with Medicare. As a society, we decided not to do that. You have a lot more flexibility and options when you're working and knowing what the tax rates are going to be for the next 15 years. Then when you're 65, ready to retire, and suddenly someone tells you that the costs of health care are going to be much higher than you thought they were.
Well,
so I think that it's probably a little fairer to do it on the taxpayer side. I suspect we'll do it on both if we do it in a balanced way.
What would a balanced way look like?
I think a balanced way would look like a very modest increase in the payroll tax, a commitment to continue funding out of general revenues as we do for other parts of the program, and some changes in terms of what beneficiaries have to pay over time. But let's remember that even if policy does not change, the costs of Medicare to individuals in terms of the Part B premiums that they pay, in terms of the out-of-pocket costs that they're liable for, will go up faster than their incomes will go up in the future. So they're going to pay more no matter what.
There's talk of means testing Medicare. Of course, it is means tested now, isn't it, parts of it?
It certainly is. And it is much more so than a lot of people understand. We treat as high income individuals with incomes of $85,000 a year or more. Now, that's pretty good income, but remember the tax debate where we said, you know, we have to feel sorry for anybody who makes less than $250,000 a year. So we already ask people who are in that range to pay a substantially higher share of the costs of the program, and we ask them when they're younger to pay substantial payroll taxes. The payroll tax does not have a limit on it as it does in Social Security for Medicare, and that means that if you have a $10 million salary, you pay 10 times as much as someone with a $1 million salary and all the way down the line. So you're already paying a lot. And in 2013, part of the Affordable Care Act asks high-income individuals to pay even higher payroll taxes going forward.
My son, who's in college right now, and many other young people, they say, yeah, it's not going to be there. Medicare won't be there. Of course, if they believe that, they have a self-fulfilling prophecy. But what do they need to know about what policy should be in place, Marilyn Moon?
One thing I would say, one thing they should remember is that people have been saying that since the early 1940s when Social Security began. People have been doubting it would be there for them. We have always changed these programs, Social Security and Medicare, to keep up with the times. So Medicare has been much closer to insolvency than in the past. In the past than it is today, and we've made changes. I think the most important thing we need to do as a society is seek better efficiency in our healthcare delivery system. That will help not only people while they're young, but people in Medicare as well. That includes things like making sure that we only pay for things that work and making sure that we organize healthcare more efficiently than it is today. We could go a long way to getting us to where we need to be. If we did some of those things, we'd still have to pay a little more somewhere, someone will, but we could solve a lot of the problems going forward. But we're going to have to be patient about that. Reforms don't come overnight, and you don't solve the problem that was a long time coming by expecting it to suddenly get better in 2015 or 2016.
Well, of course, theoretically, the first stages of the Affordable Care Act changes are supposed to put into place at least a direction toward getting us more reasonable health care.
Absolutely. And some of that is already going on. There are a lot of innovations being studied right now and being studied in the context of the Medicare program because that's where government has some control over what happens. So I think that that's going to have to continue in earnest. And things like studies that say, does this drug work as well as another drug, are very important. And we haven't funded those things very well yet, but we should.
All right, Marilyn Moon, I hope we can continue getting educated by you and by others as this debate unfolds. I appreciate you taking the time.
I'd be happy to be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Marilyn Moon is Senior Vice President, Director of the Healthcare Program at the American Institutes for Research. We have a link to their work and who funds them at all at KUOW.
And now, the sound of the day.
Somebody get into my house and record me? That's the sound of a King Charles Spaniel named Chubby sleeping. Weekday listener Sammy recorded the sound, saying that Chubby is the noisiest snorer in the house. Oh, that's a lovely sound that dog is making. All right, so who's keeping you up at night? Or what other sounds are you hearing in the course of your day or your night? Record 30 seconds. Send it to us. We want to hear the sound of your day. You know, we put that montage of many of your sounds from last year that Amina Al-Sadi put together up on Facebook, and it's a lot of fun to hear all these different sounds. And if you have some sounds to share with us, it'd be great. 30-second recording. Attach it to an email, weekday at kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. Nancy Pearl will join us Wednesday. The president is coming up. You have a good day.
It's 10 a.m. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 50 degrees in Seattle. That is today's predicted high. Probably won't get any warmer than that. We've had showers through the morning, and we expect showers to continue through the day. It'll be breezy and cloudy as well. Tonight, cloudy, chance of rain, low of 43. And tomorrow, Tuesday, windy and rainy with a high of 40. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.